Thank you for joining The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Early Sunday morning near Lakeland, Florida, a 33-year-old gunman shot five people. Four died of their injuries, and this included a three-month-old infant and a 61-year-old grandmother. An 11-year-old girl survived, and she's hospitalized with serious injuries. When police responded to the scene, they found Brian Riley, a Marine veteran of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
As we approached, we saw an individual totally outfitted in body armor and looked as if he was ready to engage us all in an active shooter situation.
Riley was taken into custody and has confessed to the killings. Several news reports indicate that Riley was suffering from PTSD and delusional thinking and may have been using methamphetamines at the time he shot the victims. The violence is horrible, but not rare. Since the start of 2021, there have been 569 mass shootings in the United States. And gun violence happens in cities and towns across the country. It happens most often between people who know each other, and it happens most often in our own homes. And it happens in our schools. Schools have been closed for most of the year in much of the country. Still, in 2021, schools have been the site of 14 shootings that have killed or injured 19 people. The most recent shooting was on September 1st at Mount Tabor High School in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Here is Winston-Salem Police Chief Katrina Thompson holding back tears as she tells local reporters that William Chavis Raynard Miller Jr. was shot and killed while attending school.
One student was located with a gunshot wound. Medical responders began life-saving measures, and the injured student was transported to Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center, where he succumbed to his injuries.
I live in Winston-Salem. The college campus where I teach is less than 3 miles from Mount Tabor High. And just after noon last Wednesday, I received a voicemail alerting of an active shooter situation and telling parents where to gather.
Parents should now report to the Harris Teeter and not to the Robin Hood YMCA to be reunited with their children.
I spent the next 4 hours in the parking lot of a local grocery store. And as the parents of Mount Tabor's more than 1,500 students gathered to wait for the safe return of their children, the stress was obvious.
I don't got nobody under control.
Listen, don't do that.
Where are the kids at?
We don't have them here.
Where you? Where they at?
They're at the school. They're still at the school.
Let them out there tonight.
What the hell?
Man, come on, man. Don't move. They don't have nothing under control.
But even amid the chaos, with police helicopters buzzing overhead, I was able to speak with several parents and students who were trying to make sense of the situation.
It's not the first time that a gun's been opened. It's just not the first time that there's been a shooting. It's not. And we become so desensitized to it until it slaps you in the face and you have to deal with it.
Another parent I spoke with also identified the desire to seem strong rather than weak as a motivation for teens to turn to guns.
When they fight, and if they lose a fight, the kids bully them and they clown them for fighting.
I talked with a Mount Tabor student who'd been in a fight at school the week before, and he recounted several school fights in recent days and told me he'd expected more disruption, but was surprised the situation had escalated to gun violence.
I had a feeling that something was gonna happen, but I didn't know it was gonna be like this, because, you know, I had got to a fight like second day of school. So from what I heard, you know, I was at the bus light and all I heard was like a gunshot, but I didn't know it was really a gunshot.
I spoke with one parent whose child indicated she no longer wanted to attend school.
She wants me to homeschool her, and I said, I'm a nurse, I work. And I said, honey, no, I can't homeschool you. She doesn't like online school. She's ADD, doesn't take any medicine. She has to focus, and she has to be with somebody. But this is just downright scary.
And I asked everyone I spoke with about their plans to return to school.
Do you think she'll want to go back?
Yes. I don't think she will. I don't know. But I will definitely do whatever's best for my kids.
Mount Tabor High School students return today to the classroom. And it can be difficult to feel safe or create a sense of safety for our young people when everything from the national news to the school hallways reinforces stress, fear, uncertainty, and violence. Joining me is Dr. Warren Ng, a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University and president-elect of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Great to have you here, Dr. Ng.
Thank you for having me and inviting us to discuss this really important topic.
Absolutely. Also with us is Dr. Jonathan Metzl, professor of sociology and professor of psychiatry and director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Metzl, thank you also for being here.
It's my honor to be part of this conversation. Thank you.
Now, Dr. Metzl, I also want to begin with you. Let's start in Florida. What do you make of the reports that Riley was a Marine veteran suffering from PTSD?
Well, I mean, again, it's very hard to know in this case. And certainly we're one day after this horrible shooting, and more details, I think, will come to light. I would say, just based on the media reports that I've been seeing and the police reports, there are multiple possible triggers here. I mean, certainly this is somebody who had seen combat, and so PTSD is an option. Very important. It looks like there's some substance use, heavy meth use possibly recently, and then the possible history of other kinds of mental illness. But we'll see what happens. I think it's important to note always in these kind of cases that many, many tens, hundreds of thousands of other people who fit such a profile, Army veterans, people with diagnosable mental illness, don't go on to commit mass shootings like this, and certainly census ones like this one seems to be. And so it's important to note that there are probably individual level factors that don't have anything to do with those categories.
Yeah, Dr. Metzl, let me just one more beat on this. You've written co-authored a recent academic journal article, and in it, you and your co-authors write in part, quote, "We need to understand the psychologies of individual shooters within larger structures and systems." Can you kind of give us a sense of how that might change a bit how we're even talking about right now what's happening in Lakeland, Florida?
Well, I think in the aftermath of these horrific shootings, of course, the question on everybody's mind is, why would somebody commit such a senseless act? And very often we turn to questions that are based in individual psychology. What made somebody snap? What were the psychological pressures, et cetera? But what we did in that article and in other research that we've been doing recently is, if you just tell the story of what happens in these mass shootings, there are so many other factors that are upstream factors. What were the gun laws in that area? How did that person get their guns? Was there a history of larger issues like substance abuse, factors like that? Were there socioeconomic pressures? And so the argument that we make in our research is, you really have to look upstream ultimately at what were the bigger factors that led to a particular shooting and that might help us prevent them in the future.
Now, Dr. Ng, I want to come to you on some of these upstream factors a little bit, in part because as I was talking with parents and students a week ago after the Mount Tabor shooting, I was surprised to hear from so many parents and kids that even though we'd only been in school about 8 days, there had already been multiple fights, students already being suspended from school. And I'm wondering if this can indicate like a level of stress and trauma connected with that COVID year of remote learning.
Thank you, Melissa. And I totally echo Dr. Metzl's very wise thoughts really about the upstream issues. And you had shared that the past year and a half has been an incredibly challenging year for everyone, and in particular for students and young people, and thinking about how disrupted their lives have become, and also affecting every aspect of their well-being, their social-emotional well-being, their family, their friends, their educational experiences. And I think one of the things we've appreciated is that over the year and a half, there have been an increase in mental health related concerns, because as we can appreciate, the pandemic was not necessarily just a medical experience. It was a psychological one with regards to social distancing and all of the safety precautions that were in place. But all of those things add to the burden of the experience that speaks to Dr. Metzl's upstream indicators of the challenges related to the stresses of being in a pandemic. And I think children and adolescents have experienced that in different ways. And when we've looked at some of the studies that have looked at mental health conditions presentations within the emergency rooms, we see that for children ages 5 to 11, there was a 24% increase in emergency room visits. And those are indicating their higher acuity, more intense presentations for mental health issues. And then there was a 31% increase in terms of adolescents. And we have definitely seen this also among the adults. So when we think about who surrounds children in creating that caring and supporting environment, those are the parents and or caregivers, and they have been disproportionately affected, particularly within communities of color.
This is such a good point. I want to just stay on this for one second, Dr. Ng. In the context of the pandemic, both the parents, obviously the teachers, the community, as well as the young people are experiencing this depression, anxiety, the sense of potential, you know, loss of fiscal resources in the household. But I'm wondering, are there ways that young people process these stressors differently, either in how they manifest them or even how they think about them or experiencing them in their own minds and bodies?
Definitely. So for children and adolescents, we have to be appreciative of their developmental age and where they are in terms of their social, emotional, and psychological development. So we want to approach young people where they're at and be mindful of how they experience their world. And a lot of anxiety and depression, also grief and bereavement in the past year, as many young people have also lost loved ones. And within New York State, we had the United Hospital Foundation's Ripple Effect study, which looked at within the first 5 months of the pandemic, Black or African American child was 1 in 600 would have lost their parent or caregiver, and 1 in 700 Latinx or Hispanic children and adolescents. So I think we're just appreciating the fact that young people are experiencing a lot of different things. And it's important for us to be able to listen and learn and engage in dialogue with them. The way that they cope with different things really depends on who's around them and also what skills and what strategies they have available. So part of that is, how do we communicate with young people? How do we understand what they're going through? And it's important for us to really take a step back, first check ourselves so that we can be in our best position to be helpful, because we can also be affected by similar things, but also then listen in terms of the young people and maintaining communication. And many young people have been communicating virtually during this past year and a half. And part of it is that level of connection may be different from the quality of experience of being in person. And so we want to be able to really understand, hear, and learn from the young people what they really need and what they're really going through.
So Dr. Metzl, let's talk about guns for a moment, because all of these various experiences of stress, anxiety, depression that we've been considering, how is it that guns and the availability of guns change what those experiences then manifest, how they manifest?
Well, I just want to agree with what Dr. Ng was just saying, that we've had, I mean, to call this one of the stressful years, really one of the more stressful years in the history of our species, in a way. And there was a moment for me in the pandemic. We were in lockdowns. Things were starting to ease up. People were starting to kind of get back out into the public arena. And people probably remember that as people started to filter back into schools and movie theaters and workplaces, there were several high-profile mass shootings, one in Atlanta and one in Colorado. And at the time, the news reports were saying, oh my gosh, you know, the minute we go back into public, now these mass shootings are happening again. And in a way, that's understandable, right? I mean, certainly mass shootings, as we think about them, are these high profile, you know, very kind of public target kinds of horrific acts. But it's important to note that several factors have been happening over the course of the pandemic that really lay the foundation for the kinds of shootings we're having, including those high-profile mass shootings. Number one, we've seen astronomical rises in just the number of guns, civilian-owned guns in circulation. The pandemic set off really a panic buying almost of weapons. And people probably remember in the beginning of the pandemic, there were around the block lines at many gun stores or across the country. That was furthered by the Trump administration designating gun stores as kind of essential businesses. So people were buying guns like Purell or toilet paper almost, you know. And so part of the issue is there are just many more guns out in circulation. And the other important point is that because of that, there were many kinds of shootings that didn't make it to the news, shootings that happened in houses, in isolation, partner violence, you know, higher risk of suicide, all these other shootings. And so it really is, I think, a really potentially very toxic mix of a remarkably tense situation where life and death, you know, because of the pandemic, is far more real than really we imagined it to be before. And then adding guns to the mix just makes things all the more volatile. And so in a way, these high profile mass shootings are just tips of the iceberg of much bigger cultural dynamics that I think we have to worry about. And the last part of that is that there's a lot of legislation in states like Tennessee and Texas and a case coming before the Supreme Court that are going to, I think, overturn the gun laws that have protected, I think, public spaces like this. So it's a really dangerous and urgent moment, not just for the world because of the pandemic, but in the U.S. because we've added guns to this mix.
Dr. Ng, as I listen to Dr. Metzl talk about the such a stressful and dangerous moment, I'll also say that I was quite moved and have been quite moved by the ways that there has been, simultaneous with this trauma in Winston-Salem, there's also been community building. I mean, as simple as, you know, there were local community organizations, faith-based organizations who were in the parking lot with the parents on that hot afternoon, you know, passing out free water bottles and other schools, you know, making Facebook posts and songs for the young people and the parents and the teachers of Mount Tabor. I'm wondering about the ways that we can learn from an acute stress like this to actually build those community ties across the more durable stresses that we're all experiencing.
Thank you, Melissa. I think that you've got to the root of what is so important. And if there's anything that we can learn from the past year and a half or 2 years with the pandemic, it's really the importance of one another and our connections to one another and how much we need one another in terms of getting through the most difficult times. And I think that what you've spoken about at Mount Tabor really brings to focus how important we are to one another. And so community building, faith-based organizations, parents groups, teachers, communities, and just human beings being able to support one another. I think that that is really the key to what we hope is a silver lining in any of these difficult experiences. I think that it's important for us to really build upon really the local strengths and the regional strengths and also the strengths within each other during these times. And it's really in the small acts that we can make the most impact, as we've seen and as you've mentioned. And I think one of the things with the upstream effects that Dr. Metzl has also drawn upon is just the fact that in the past year and a half, a lot of the issues related to mental health, substance abuse, stressors, food insecurity, economic hardship, racial stress and trauma, as well as many other additional concerns such as the COVID-19 concerns related to vaccine hesitancy or just fears of infection, as well as mortality and loss and death. I think all of those things really compound a situation where how do we get through the most difficult times? And the important answer is together. And so how can we build those connections, even in our divisive, I think, society at this point on many different levels? How do we reach across the aisle or across the table to another to find that humanity that I think speaks to what we all crave during the most difficult times? And I think that you're hitting on the most important point in all of this, because I think we need each other in order to get through this.
Dr. Warren Ng is president-elect for the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and Dr. Jonathan Metzl is professor of sociology and of psychiatry at Vanderbilt University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And if you or someone you know is suffering and struggling right now, please know there are resources to help. You can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number at 1-800-273-8255 or the Crisis Text Line. Text HELLO to 741-741. This is Melissa Harris-Perry with you on The Takeaway. Glad to have you back from the holiday and the long weekend. We hope you had some time for reflection or relaxation, maybe just a little fun. In any event, we needed a break from some heavy news, and we know you do too. So here we go. During the past month, we've been asking you to share with us slices of your life in audio form, just a small snippet of how your life sounds. And you have been delivering some truly great audio. Let's start with Kimber.
Okay, so this is the sound that is a train coming in. It's a kind of a unique sound. That's the electric commuter train, and it was coming in slow.
I love that. That's great, Kimber. And you weren't the only one with a connection to trains. Check this one out. Now, that's from Yvette in California. She tells us, "My son is a rail fan, so I take him to railroad crossings all over the country where he can film rare or unusual engines, sometimes with special horns, and post them to his YouTube channel for other rail fans to enjoy." She told us the locomotive was Amtrak number 171, which many rail fans consider the best sounding horn on Amtrak's system. Meanwhile, Christina from San Jose takes us with her to her first ballet class at a high school. Ah, very nice. Okay, so a lot of you were loving on nature with your audio. This one was pretty close to home.
Hi, this is Susan McLawhorn. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm visiting my brother in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I can hear the cicadas in the trees, and it's really hot here. And there's a band playing, a live band, and there's people walking down the street, and there's a lot of energy in the air tonight.
Cicadas, a live band. Now, for the rest of y'all, many of y'all love the birds, and you sent us some amazing bird songs, starting with Dee Dee in San Francisco, sending us some gulls. Frankie in Minnesota sent us some loons from the cabin where he grew up. And meanwhile, Ellen recorded her slice of life in a Midas parking lot. She thinks this might be a parrot. Takeaway birders, y'all gotta help us out with this one. And finally, some more unknown feathered friends from Kenya in Mississippi. Those might be pterodactyls. Listen, some of you also sent us sounds of the machines in your lives. A listener in Armonk, New York, sent us this sound of their mat cutter from their framing shop. Here's another machine from Alex.
I work on cell sites. So segment of the day starts with hopping out of the truck, grabbing what I need, and walking over to what we call the shelter, which is where the brains of a cell site live. Up on the tower, you have the antennas and the radios, and downstairs are the basebands and routers that drive it all. You can hear the fans from afar as you walk into the shelter. Inside, it's basically just a series of whirling fans.
And Rob from New Jersey sent us some woodshop moments. That's some chair sanding there from Rob. And finally, at least one of you wasn't thrilled about the surrounding sound.
I am trying to prepare a video lecture for a class that I'm teaching, but my building is under renovation, and I am unfortunately being serenaded by the sound of saws in the background.
These are all so great. Please keep these coming. Remember, you can record on your phone or your gear or just whatever you got. Email us the sound file at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. That's takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Tell us a story about it too. More of these soon, folks. Thanks for the slice of your life.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
That's the voice of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, delivering his first inaugural address in March 1933. America's longest-serving president, FDR led the nation out of the Depression and through World War II. He ushered in a New Deal and established both the minimum wage and Social Security. President Roosevelt also issued Executive Order 9066 shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The order forcibly removed all people of Japanese descent from their homes and communities. This included U.S. citizens.
The only thing we have to fear is...
From 1942 to 1945, the American government incarcerated more than 100,000 Japanese Americans in isolated camps with brutal living conditions.
The only thing we have to fear is...
Anyone with even 1/16th Japanese ancestry was rounded up and had to report to an assembly center. Then they were sent to a relocation center. Topaz, Colorado River, Gila River, Granada, Jerome, Manzanar, Minidoka, Rower, Tule Lake, Heart Mountain. 10 sites where the U.S. government imprisoned its own citizens solely because of their identity.
The only thing we have to fear is...
The last of the prison camps closed in 1946. In 1988, Congress passed the Civil Liberties Act, which awarded victims of the internment camps the amount of $20,000 each in reparations. The act was sponsored by then California Congressman Norman Mineta, who himself was incarcerated in an internment camp during the war. Mineta has had a long and distinguished career of service, first as mayor of San Jose and as a U.S. congressman, Secretary of Commerce under President Clinton, and then Secretary of Transportation under President George W. Bush. Mineta spent his life in service to a country that once denied him and his family their freedom, property, and humanity. I had the honor to speak with Secretary Mineta and ask him how he was made to feel like a stranger in his own country.
These big placards were being posted, and it said, attention, all those of Japanese ancestry, alien and non-alien. And I was 10 years old at the time, and I saw this placard being put up. And I said to my brother, who is 9 years older than me, I said, hey, well, what's a non-alien? He said, that's you. I said, that's not me. I'm not a non-alien. I'm a citizen of the United States of America. That's why, to this day, and I'm now 89 years old, I cherish the word citizen because my own government would not use it to describe us.
I asked the secretary to tell us how swiftly he and his family were taken.
When Pearl Harbor occurred, about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, people were being arrested by the FBI. The reason for it was a military necessity. After we were picked up by the military, we then left San Jose on May 29 to go to a Santa Anita racetrack in the L.A. area.
The secretary is describing the assembly and relocation centers.
In November of 1943, we were then transported to Heart Mountain, Wyoming, and we were in this desolate camp for the duration of World War II.
Families were herded onto freight trains without knowing their destination.
When we boarded the freight train or the passenger train to go to camp, they wouldn't allow us to get on the trains at the passenger rail station. They had us board the trains at the freight yard. And the grammar school I went to was about three blocks from the freight yard. So some of the kids, during their lunch hour, came down to the freight yard to see us off.
2 years later, Secretary Mineta and his family were released and made their way back to his hometown of San Jose.
We arrived in San Jose on Thanksgiving Day of 1945, and that was the best Thanksgiving I've ever had, just to be able to get back into our own home, and I was just thankful to be back.
I want to thank Secretary Mineta for sharing his story with us. Despite the cruelty and racism they faced, 33,000 Japanese Americans served with distinction during the war. I spoke with Susan Kamei, author of the new book, When Can We Go Back to America? Voices of Japanese American Incarceration During World War II. And I asked her why this is the right time to tell the story of Japanese Americans who were incarcerated by their own country.
Well, actually, so many people don't even know the story. What I hear from my students at the University of Southern California is that they did not hear about it in their U.S. history classes. They might come from other parts of the country where there wasn't an awareness that this even happened during the war, let alone to 2/3 of those who were incarcerated were American citizens. They might have had, if they had any word of it, it was something glancing, or as Secretary Mineta pointed out, that it was this false narrative that, well, you have to understand, our country was attacked. We were at war with Japan. You people, the phrase, you people looked like the enemy. How could we trust you? There was the assumption of disloyalty without any evidence to that. And that is news to people because the government put forth this story that was false. The other element is that history repeats itself and that we could see issues that are going on in our society today that similarly cause a reaction based on how people look or their ethnicity, their religion, their country of origin. And these are issues that are front and center today, and this is a story that's relevant to that.
Let's begin with some of the very important clarifying work that you do at the start of the book around language. So I want you to talk to us about the language of incarceration versus internment.
Very important. Thank you for asking. The confusion comes that the term internment applies to aliens and the government ability to deal with them as aliens. And in the case of World War II, as Secretary Mineta was describing, that individuals who are not citizens but are citizens of countries with which our country is at war then become classified as enemy aliens. So they fall under the jurisdiction of what was then the Alien Control Board within the FBI and the Department of Justice. So the first generation business people and community leaders were pre-identified before even Pearl Harbor happened to be identified as those who would be immediately rounded up and detained under the power of the government to quote unquote control aliens. However, as American citizens, the term internee or internship really was inaccurately applied and was purposefully applied to blur the distinction between the parents of Secretary Mineta, my grandparents, and conflate that with the U.S. citizens, the second generation, the American-born Nisei. For them, and for all those who were under the jurisdiction of the War Relocation Authority, so approximately 120,000, what in the Japanese-American community, we believe the appropriate word is not internment to apply to U.S. citizens, but rather incarceration, to share the connotation that it was an imprisonment.
Can you talk to us a bit about how it is that the U.S. government, even as we were prosecuting a war overseas around human rights, presumably, were making a kind of argument to the other American people about what we were doing to these American people?
Yes. And so actually, I think in terms of the relevance today, the message is not that this happened to aliens, but that, or non-citizens, but that it became enlarged, it became conflated to apply to U.S. citizens.
Are you at all surprised by the level of optimism and patriotism that remains among the generation that is that lived through this?
The valor that they put forth, the sacrifice and the ultimate sacrifice that many of them made, was because they wanted to prove their loyalty, and they wanted to, they were willing to, their phrase was go for broke. They were willing to give it all. And that is just never ceases to move me to tears. The valor in that record did, in fact, make it possible for the long experience after the war that eventually helped, I think, rehabilitate the image of the Japanese Americans as citizens and as loyal citizens. It took many years, but it was also very instrumental in the passage of the Civil Liberties Act in 1988, legislation that Secretary Mineta, when he was a congressional leader, was instrumental in.
Susan, what do you make of our selective memory? And when I say our selective memory, I want to encompass a lot of communities. Those of us in media who might not want to remember the U.S. media publications that created and stoked fear of the so-called yellow peril, or the selective memory of those of us who visit sites of slavery but have never taken a trip to the racetracks or to Heart Mountain to actually stand in the places where this happened. Or maybe just the selective memory of those who might want to remember FDR as the greatest president while ignoring this part of what happened. Why do you think we do that?
Yeah, well, so there's many aspects, I think, to this. One is that we can't remember what we don't know. So first, I think there's the element, and this was a great motivation for me with this opportunity to do a book of this scope, is to first have it be known, to tell the stories. And then, of course, so many of these experiences, the one that Secretary Mineta personally was describing, happened 80 years ago. And so we have, a responsibility to know those stories, to bring them forward, and to share them, and to learn by those lessons, and that we learn from the stories and how they relate to other communities that are experiencing similar kinds of of patterns of social on the wrong side of social behavior. So many of the communities, the Japanese American communities before the war, were erased by the incarceration. For instance, there was a very vibrant Japanese American community in Tacoma, Washington. And for lots of reasons, that community after the war did not get reconstituted. The community that did come back to Los Angeles and Little Tokyo came back in a different form. And so there's also this concept of community loss and erasure, and in some cases have not ever been reformed, and that aspect of our society has been lost. So I think there's these consequences to be aware of, and that knowing what the personal effect has been and the intergenerational impact has been is an important part of what my efforts have been about too.
Can you contextualize this? You've talked a couple of times about repeating our history. Can you contextualize this within the context of the rise in anti-Asian and anti-Asian American hate here in the U.S. over the past few years?
Sure. Well, the context of the Japanese American immigration that started in the 1880s was at that time an anti-Asian environment. The Japanese immigrants walked into the prejudice and discrimination that had already taken place against the first wave of Chinese immigrants. And so as the awareness of just recently of the rise of anti-Asian hate and violence has come up, I think it's been an important thing to remember that this is not the first time that the Asian American community has experienced it, and that there's been a longstanding pattern of this. So Secretary Mineta, because of his experience, was able to share that with President Bush. And then in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks and calls from the public that started right away once the identity of the terrorists became known, that, well, we have to keep people who look like Muslims and Middle Easterners off airplanes. And in fact, we should round them up and detain them. And there were express references to, well, we did this in World War II, we're at war now, we need to do this again. These are concerns, what was called then in World War II, of military necessity, and now the phrase is of national security. And it was because of President Bush's awareness of what happened in World War II and the personal connection with Secretary Mineta's story that influenced President Bush's reaction. And he has been quoted as saying, we're not going to do what happened to Norm in 1942. And had the FAA, under Secretary Mineta's direction, issue an email to the airlines that reminding the airlines and the airport personnel that they should not be discriminating, and that the policies for airline security still need to comply with all the legal requirements of non-discrimination. So we do have some examples where we can stop the bad history from repeating. But I think this takes the collective will to remember these examples and to connect them.
Susan Kamei, author of When Can We Go Back to America? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right, everyone, thank you so much for hanging with us today. There was a lot of heavy news, so I'm glad we're in it together. Unfortunately, we end on a sad note. We couldn't let the show go by without mentioning the tragic death of legendary actor Michael K. Williams on Sunday. He died at the age of 54. Williams was a star of The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, Lovecraft Country, When They See Us, and so many more iconic TV shows, along with the film roles and more. With Williams, every character became legend.
I was born in Elgin, Texas. My daddy taught himself the carpenter trade, doing for the black folk there. I tell you, anything that man put his hand to, table, chair, wedding chest, he make that wood sing.
Y'all need to open this door, man, for a huff and puff.
What's that, gasoline?
Yeah, it could be. Old George calls it road rash. Never did tell me the ingredients. So if he was here, none of this would have happened. If I could go back in time, I'd take that bullet.
You are a parasite who leeches off
just like you,
the culture
man.
Of drug.
Excuse me?
What?
I got the shotgun. Got the briefcase. It's on the game, though, right?
Williams was twice a guest of The Takeaway. And the team remembers him as being easily one of the nicest, kindest, most thoughtful guests the show has ever hosted. The first time, back when he was doing press for The Road, he came into the studio with this tiny little dog, and the puppy stayed with Williams the entire time and never made a peep. Williams then made sure to come over to everyone in the control room, the host, the EP, the engineers, even the interns. He said hello, introduced himself, asked their names, shook their hands. He plainly cared about each person he met. He was unbelievably gracious with his time and energy, and it left an impression beyond his work. My mentor, Maya Angelou, often said people will not remember your words, but they will remember how you made them feel. How he made the team of The Takeaway feel will not be forgotten.
My mentor, Michael Skolnick, he looked at me and he says, you know what, Mike? He said, the people closest to the problem are usually the ones closest to the solution. And for that, in that moment, my light bulb went off in my head and I started to look at my life.
Michael K. Williams, we miss you. Thoughts and prayers to all your people. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.
A man got to have a code.